Welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. Hey! This podcast is all about what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic, cultural, or socio-economic background to the majority. I'm going to be talking to some awesome creative leaders, as well as a bunch of brilliant planners, MDs and CEOs, getting their viewpoints and experiences about getting in and achieving success in the industry. But whether your skin happens to be brown, black, yellow, pink, green, or any shade in between, these chats are filled with a load of insight and inspiration around creativity that I believe can lead us to a better industry doing better work. My Brown Rioter today is an awesome creative director who actually hails from my neck of the woods, East London. Having said that, she's been a CD here in Sydney for 6 years now, creating award-winning work and leading departments at agencies including One Green Bean, and Log Folk, and 72 and Sunny. She's a freelance creative director, and her work for clients including Morris Blackburn Lawyers, O2 and Optus is characterised by a strong point of view and a sense of social justice, which is just one of the reasons I wanted to have her on today. She is Pia Chowdhury. Welcome, Pia.
Thank you.
I would love to start by just hearing a little bit about your family background.
Yeah, so as you've said, I come from East London. I was born there in the sound of the Bow Bells, even though I'm probably not as Cockney as you.
Well, you're a proper Cockney.
I know.
You're a proper Cockney.
But both my parents are Indian immigrants to London, so they moved over in the 60s. Also, and yeah, I grew up in this kind of weird world where at home it was one way, and then in life and the rest of the world it was a whole other way, and I've just always been used to that.
This was Bethnal Green, wasn't it? Were your first words. So when you talk about sort of two ways of life, do you mean that your friendship group was quite mixed in terms of different backgrounds and cultures?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, obviously Bethnal Green was a certain way. And Bethnal Green now is not the Bethnal Green that I grew up in. And, you know, East London,
not so many hipsters in those days.
Very, very few hipsters. Shoreditch was like derelict land, believe it or not. And yeah, I think it was a very tough environment to grow up in. But my parents, you know, they spoke a different language. They looked different. They had a whole different culture at home to the one that my friends had at school or just around me, and I was always a bit torn as to which one I belonged to. Inevitably, I went with my friends over my family, as you do, and so I think I've come out this way for that reason.
How was it when your friends came over to your house? Were they freaked out in terms of the completely different alien culture, or was it were people more accepting?
No, people were not accepting at all in those days. Right. It was very racist at the time. There was a lot of kind of gangs, and it was segregation between sort of cultures. My primary school itself was quite mixed, so it wasn't too bad. But then by the time I went to secondary school, I went to a Church of England school. And so for a community that's very brown, I suppose, it was one of the whitest schools in the area. And so I then met like a whole other group of people and probably felt a bit embarrassed about having people over, to be honest.
Mm. Where you grew up and your background is similar to mine. I've probably had some similar experiences there. I was just going to ask about first experiences of racism, because I remember I grew up in Forest Gate, which is just down the road, and I recall I must have been about 6 or 7, and there was a lot of tension in Forest Gate, racial tension. There was a mini race riot every weekend,
yeah,
to be honest.
Definitely.
But I remember one weekend there was quite a bad one, windows smashed and so on, and NF daubed on the walls everywhere. And I remember saying to my mum, what is that? And my mum having to explain that it's the National Front, and they kind of think this, and they don't like brown people and all that. Did you have any experiences
like that? It was very similar,
like
yeah. We had, you know, gangs of skinheads and then brown people being bashed. It was quite a terrifying time, really, like when I think back now. And to think that area is now just full of like cool bars and boutique shops and, you know, is completely different. There's almost no like remnants of that time.
I think that's the big difference for me between the sort of slightly more inner city of Bethnal Green, and Forest Gate, where I'm from, is just one of those areas that will never be gentrified. Mm. I think you can still buy a 4-bedroom house in Forest Gate for like £25,000. It's
no
just
way.
Yeah, it's just, there'll never be a Starbucks or, you know, a hipster cafe in Forest Gate. I want to segue this into talking about your job and the advertising industry and all of that, and I just kind of wonder, your first job in advertising, where was that? That was in London, I presume.
Yeah, it was in London. So it was at this agency called DAD, which actually stood for Digital and Direct.
I've heard
at
of them.
The time. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in Battersea.
I've got a good friend who used to work there, yeah.
Oh, really? Who? A
guy called Seamus Higgins.
The guy that's ECD at
my work partner. Yeah, yeah. But he was at DAD, yeah. We always used to laugh about the fact that it wasn't DNAD, but it was just DND, yeah. Almost DNAD.
Yeah. So what happened was I just sort of ended up there, really. I studied...
From college or from...
Yeah, from college. I had no idea that there was a job called creative in advertising. I didn't really think about how advertising worked. I studied graphic design, and by the time I got to the final year, I realised that I wasn't a very good designer, but I was good at concepts. And so... I remember one of my friends saying to me, so what are you going to do when you graduate? Because it was really looming. And I said, I don't know, because I don't think I can be a designer. And so I explained my situation. She said, well, you know, there's a job for that. It's called creative. And she was working at DAD at the time. And so she was like, well, once you've graduated, give me a shout, come and do some work experience with us. And so just like that, I finished college a couple of months later and then just went straight into DAD.
Okay. And then to tie that back to what we were talking about before, the experiences of racism in East London and that sort of the stuff that went on in your upbringing, was that, how did you feel about that side of things by the time you were working?
It was different. I mean, to be honest, it was like worlds apart by the time I started working to where I grew up. I mean, it wasn't a very simple transition. I think I was quite lucky in some ways in how I ended up at art college in the first place, because I think that, you know, in that environment, kids don't go to art college. They barely finish school. So what happened was, well, the school that I was talking about, Raines Foundation, it's my high school, I had a couple of teachers there who were like really trendy, or I thought so at the time. They were like the cool ones, and they taught technology, and the technology subjects being like fashion came under that weirdly, graphic design. And they just did not fit the mold of what teachers were like, and they were quite young. And they introduced me to the arts, essentially. And before that, being of Indian parents, you're either a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant. There's no other way. There's no other option. And, you know, my parents really tried to make me very academic, but I never was. And I was always more creative, but it was not an option to be a creative person. Whereas these guys, they showed me that you could be. And so it's funny, because I was actually listening to a podcast this morning about a guy that had quite a similar experience, in that a teacher sort of said to him, you need to get out of this school. And so what happened was, for sixth form, I ended up leaving that secondary school because I knew that if I wanted to pursue anything artistic, I couldn't do it there. And I ended up going to this other school in Camden, which is obviously, you know, London, so very liberal, completely different, very rich as well, area. And somehow got into this sixth form that has the best art department in the country. And I think they sort of took me on as like that. Maybe they got a bigger grant for taking me on. And so I ended up going there for 2 years, and I was surrounded by all of a sudden not working class people, but middle class people who just felt like the world was their oyster and they could do anything. And it just completely changed how I looked at everything. And so I ended up doing art there, and then chose graphic design as my university degree, and then went to another extremely liberal place in Brighton, and there just kind of honed my skills, I suppose, and also my outlook on life. And only because that happened did I end up meeting my friend who gave me that foot in the door into this industry. But it feels like a real sliding doors moment. Like, if that hadn't have happened, who knows, like, what I would be right now, a failing accountant somewhere probably, because I'm terrible with money. So yeah, so I think it was kind of luck, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we had Ash on, Ash from BWM, the other week, and he had a sort of a slightly similar story in that he's from an Indian background. His parents said lawyer, doctor, these are the professions, you know, and he kind of said, oh, hang on, I want to be in advertising. They were like, what is this nonsense? What is this creative, you know, nonsense? And he kind of had to sort of push quite hard to say, no, it's a thing, I know about it, I'm going to do it. And they eventually saw that it was a good thing. How were your parents when you sort of started going to crazy Camden?
My mum still doesn't believe that I have a real job. She has no idea what I do. I've tried to explain it to her a million times. And it's funny hearing her explain it to other people. She really doesn't have a clue what I do.
When you show her, when you send her the work, when you send her the links or the, you know.
She doesn't get it. She has no idea how it was made or what my role in that could possibly be. So, yeah, she wasn't impressed. And she was much more dictatorial around what I did. And both my parents were teachers, actually, when I was growing up. And she was of extreme academic. Back in India, she'd been quite brilliant at her studies. Yeah. And so she sort of expected me to be the same, but I just...
Yeah, went to the genes, went to the DNA. Okay, and then just to take that context, and then we'll sort of move forward to DNAD, that first job.
Dad.
What was the cultural makeup there? Was it quite mixed because it was London, or was it fairly one-dimensional in terms of everyone being from one background?
It's funny. I mean, it was quite a long time ago now, but I don't really remember noticing that I was brown. So, I mean, by that point, I sort of stopped noticing what colour I was and I was just doing my work. I was so grateful to be in a job where I could actually use my skill set, although... One of the things they made me do was, you know, I was obviously just a lowly intern, and they just got me to cut down A0 mount board to A4 for like a whole day with a scalpel and a ruler.
Did you take any tops of fingers off? Or did
I did.
You?
That's what I was going to say. I literally sliced off the top of my middle finger. And I had basically freaked out because it was just bleeding. And then they felt bad and they gave me a desk, a proper desk, because I was doing that on the floor as well. So, yeah.
So that was how you got your job, by slicing your finger off. I touched on the race thing there. And, like I was saying before, the more you become, maybe as you get older, the more you kind of become more comfortable in your own skin, the less you notice that it's a thing. For me, it was a little bit like, as I got older and I got more comfortable in my own skin, it was more like water off a duck's back for me. You know, if people wanted to have that attitude, that was their issue, not mine. I thought, as I got older, when I was younger, it was kind of hurtful and painful and all of that. And that's partly the dichotomy I think we've got with this podcast. Part of me wants it, sort of race and background and all that, to just not be a thing. And part of me wants to celebrate difference and sort of celebrate the, you know, the achievements of people of colour or whatever. So it's quite an interesting contradiction. And the reason I bring that up is because I think when I started out in advertising, I looked around and it was very white. And kind of, not that I had a massive issue with it, but I've subscribed to this theory that if you can see it, you can be it. Me, there's something around seeing people that are like you in some way, whether that's sort of race, gender, whatever it is, age, makes me feel that I can do that too. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think that's really important for young people, especially, or people starting out in the industry. I think even, you know, from a gender perspective, seeing female CEOs who have had kids, you know, for me now, that's a big thing. I think it's super important to have diversity within a company and an industry as a whole. So yeah, 100% agree with that.
And how do you feel about specifically the Australian industry? Because I think there's a lot of talk of diversity, but I find it quite vanilla.
And when you say vanilla, you mean white?
Well, I mean it is that, but I didn't mean that, but I just mean it's kind of quite one-dimensional. I'll often sit in, you know, I sit in lots of meetings all day with a group of people where I'm the only brown person, and there's not often many females in the room.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, 100%. I actually think that the Australian industry is much more a monoculture than the English one. So, yeah, I've obviously noticed that since I've been here as well. But I guess I just try not to think about it too much. I think, you know, a lot of women also say they don't want to be hired because they're a woman. They want to be hired based on their skills and merit, obviously. And, you know, I feel the same about the colour that I am. Like, I want to be good at my job first and foremost and be hired for that reason. But having said all of that, you know, there are occasions when I feel quite uncomfortable. Like, I think there's times when you're around a certain kind of laddishness in the industry, and, well, A, being a woman, but then also from such a different background, I have zero in common with these people. And, you know, sometimes they're your clients, and it's really difficult to relate. And I think they find it difficult to relate to me as well. And I think that sometimes that impacts whether or not they will buy an idea even.
How do you get around that? What do you do in those situations? Because I think you're right, like kind of attracts like, and it's, you know, it's hard to relate to people that, you know, and for your ideas to resonate with people when they kind of don't have that rapport with you.
Yeah.
What's your handy hints for cracking that?
I don't know if I've mastered it, to be honest. I think, you know, there's been occasions where other people have had to step in and, you know, sell it for me, for example, or, you know, the after sell. So you've done the presentation and then someone else will walk in and have a word with the client afterwards and say, no, I think this is a really good idea. So, you know, can be a bit humiliating, I suppose. But do you have any tips around it?
I think, I do. But I think that makes me feel like I'm a bit of a weak-willed chameleon, because I feel like I just slightly bend my personality to suit the audience or the environment or the, you know, the people around me, which I'm not sure that's such a great thing or not.
I think that's just human nature, but I think that the reality is I look the way that I do and I am the gender that I am, and no matter how much I try and do that, I think I just have to do my best and hope that they see past who the idea is coming from. The main place I ended up at in London before I came here was a place called PD3, which is this like little boutique agency in Shoreditch. And they started off like a long time ago as an agency that basically did experiential stuff. But over time it evolved and they started doing lots of different things. And that's where I was working on O2. We did some really amazing work there. And I was there for about 4 years before I came out to Sydney.
And then when you got here, you've kind of worked at a few places, haven't you? You've worked at Analog Folk and One Green Bean and stuff. Mm. I wanted to touch on some of the work that you've done. So the Maurice Blackburn Law Firm campaign that I sort of mentioned before, it's just really interesting, powerful work. And like I said before, work with a real point of view. Is that something that you try to put in everything you do, or is that just that particular project?
That project it's one of my favourite pieces of work that I've done. It was particularly poignant because I think for me, in some ways, it was a pivotal moment in the way that I feel about the work that I do. Like, for the first time, I was able to produce something that was really about social consciousness, and therefore, yeah, it's got a huge point of view. It's ironic, really, because it's for a law firm, and most people would run a mile from a brief for a law firm, but it was an interesting challenge that they had. Like, being a law firm, everyone hates them, think they're money-grabbing ambulance chasers, and that was from the client, her words. But they're a law firm with a difference in that they have this whole other arm that's just purely about social justice, and it's completely pro bono. And they'd never done a piece of brand work that was just about that side of the business. So that was our brief, really, was to drive awareness of that side of them, but also about the importance of social justice as a whole. So that was awesome, because essentially the strategy was really good in that it sort of highlighted this quite obvious point, which is, you know, most people think that social justice is only about Indigenous rights or asylum seekers or gay rights, for example, but actually the whole point of it is that if people over there don't have the right to do something, that means that you don't either, whether it affects you or not, and it's in the eyes of the law anyway. So it was about the fact that, you know, the campaign line was "your right is my right," and so it was about reframing all of that to make it relevant to every single individual, not just people who are disadvantaged.
Somehow, we've misplaced the fair go. If we deny one person's right to be free, be safe, be heard, or be equal, then we risk everyone else's rights too. Because your right is my right, and mine is yours too. And without it, none of us get a fair go.
You just said that reframed the way you look. You looked at work or at the work that you do. I think that's really interesting, because I've got this belief or passion that, you know, we do so much work in this industry. I don't want to be spending my days and my precious time of my life, you know, just pumping out stuff to fill up 15-second social media ads or whatever, just because There's all these spaces we can just chuck anything in. And I want to make sure that anything that I do and my teams do add something to people's life, whether that sort of helps them or entertains them or informs in some way. But having said that, that's quite high-minded and idealistic, and then you get to work and you've got kind of briefed to do a 6-second bumper for something or a banner ad for something or whatever it might be. How do you balance the passion and the slightly idealistic belief that that's the sort of stuff you want to get into your work with the reality of the day-to-day briefs?
I think as long as there's a bit of both, you know that there's the bread and butter work that you need to do to almost fund this other stuff. I don't think I would be happy somewhere that had no work that fulfilled me on a personal level. But yeah, I agree. I actually think that we have a lot of responsibility as an industry in terms of how much of an impact we have on the way people think and act. And I don't think we wield that power necessarily as responsibly as we could. I think if you think about how people are portrayed in ads, it has, and culture and the media in general, there's only a finite number of people that work in this industry, and we know how to change views and behaviour. So why aren't we all doing it for what's right? And I don't mean that every single thing we do, like that 6-second banner ad, needs to be about sustainability or diversity or equality. But there are small ways that we could be moving towards that without even making it obvious. Like, for example, the products that we buy for the shoot, are they all recycled? Or, you know, is there, do we make sure that the people we cast are diverse enough? There's things that we can be doing without, like, actually having it in the line. Mm. Or the full concept.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you talked about the great power that this industry wields and the responsibility that comes with that. That made me wonder, are there lines that you wouldn't cross or that you haven't crossed? Are there kind of products or brands that you wouldn't, you know, that you wouldn't work on? Or do you see that as you balance up that bit of trying to work with some other work?
I think there's only been one thing that I have said that I didn't want to work on, and that was back in London, and it was actually for Boots the chemist, and our brief was, oh, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Day, let's do something so we look like we care. Mm. And my mum had just been going through chemo at the time, so it was just really bad timing, and it felt so shallow that I said no. I think that ultimately you have to be professional in your job as well. If you're hired to do something, you need to do your job. There's things that I would hate to say or claim if they were completely false, but I would probably try and avoid doing that somehow in the work.
What was the outcome of you refusing to work on the...
They put someone thing? Else on it.
Yeah, you didn't, yeah. You didn't lose your job or end up in a shit fight or... Because I'm a great believer in that old Bill Birnbach thing about a principle's not a principle until it costs you money, because words are cheap and it's easy to say this, that and the other, but when the crunch comes, you know, that's when our true sort of nature comes out. I mean, for me, my boots moment was I'm quite a passionate vegetarian, and DDB, as you know, has McDonald's. I couldn't work on that, and I just wouldn't. Working on something like that would just go against everything, every grain of my being, which is, you know, and there's other unethical brands that I probably have worked on that you could say, well, hang on, what about that car brand or whatever? But I think some things, like you said, the thing about your mum, they're just so personal that it's just, you can't go there, can you? What are the bits of work you see out there that you're really loving, or is the kind of work that you wish you'd done?
You know, there's one campaign that I really love at the moment, and that's the Trash Aisles thing that Lad Bible and BBDO did. Yep. Like, it's obviously not that current, but I just love that campaign so much. Such a simple idea based on this really interesting nugget of information that someone obviously happened across and then executed so brilliantly across so many channels. Yeah, I just wish I'd done that.
I love when there's an idea with a breadth of different channels, and all of those channels down to the smallest thing have just been so well executed, like that Trash Aisles thing. I just love that the currency is called the debris, and like there's little sort of Easter eggs along the way on that thing, isn't there?
It's really, really well done, well thought out.
Because ideas like that are, they're a bit PR, they're a bit of advertising, they're a bit sort of experiential. Is that where your sort of main passion lies?
Yeah, and I think it's where my skill set lies because of the types of places that I've worked at. I think, as I was saying before, I've always found it more interesting to think of stuff that people want to engage with, because it's harder and you have to really get into people's mindsets, plus know what's going on in the world and culture. I think, you know, I was at One Green Bean for nearly 4 years, and that was a real eye-opener into how PR actually works. I think that a lot of traditional creatives and agencies think they know, and nothing annoys me more now than when someone will mock up a headline front page of a newspaper with their idea in it without actually any idea of how PR works. I believe the future of advertising is earned media. I mean, you know, it's, the clues are already there. Budgets are shrinking. Clients want stuff that is going to earn attention. And so we just need to be doing more of that stuff, but building it in from the start of the concept, not just as an add-on at the end once you've come up with something.
When you kind of got big ideas like the ideas you're talking about, that means that you can execute it in one way or another way, or in lots of different ways at the same time. I always find that super exciting, but a little bit scary as well, because sometimes it's hard to know where to start. How do you kind of approach that?
I think I've always worked that way, so I prefer working that way. I think what has happened, though, is that things have been moving in that direction for a while, so it's more acceptable to not go back with a script and actually go, you know, I've made like an instrument that's played by the weather as a response to a brief for James Bogue, and you know, that was amazing. So being able to do stuff like that, or create a product that you can sell, or you know, it's way more interesting, way more fun, more tactile.
Advertising people kind of go, oh, PR, you know, we know how to do that, you know, and PR people go, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on the differences between the two worlds?
It's massively different. And I'm not saying that I think that PR is the answer to everything. I think that PR also needs to learn from creative agencies as well. And I think that actually the future is where these two things are combined seamlessly. Mm. But there's massive, massive difference. I think that even today I was at in a presentation where there was someone presenting something that they were calling a PR idea to PR people, and I felt uncomfortable for them because I knew the realities of what they were saying was just not possible, because that's not how it works. So in some ways, PR is for me a lot like, well, this is how I got my head around it, because I was just like any other creative when I first went in. It's a lot like social. It's like, if you want journalists to write about something, then it has to be something they give a shit about. So in the same way as if you create a piece of content, you put it in social, it has to be something that people want to see, right? So it's the same principle, but the difference is that with PR, it's down to individual journalists to go, yeah, that's something I think my reader base would be interested in. And so you have to target different media outlets and different journalists in really different ways around the same campaign. So it has to be a big enough idea and a big enough campaign that can be carved up in lots of different ways to be spoken about to people in different ways.
Just in terms of the sort of the creative process, though, in PR versus advertising, and because I've kind of got a, maybe it's just an opinion or a view from sort of in my experience, and you'll tell me this is bollocks if you think it's bollocks, but it just seems that in the PR world, the creative process is a little bit undervalued. Yeah. Because it's, we're going to pump out an idea in an hour's brainstorm, and then we're going to have another one tomorrow, and then another one the next day, and kind of there's not, it just doesn't seem to be the strategic rigor and the kind of the real love of strategically getting to a great space and then crafting it beautifully. It kind of just seems to be a bit more ephemeral.
I would agree, and I think that most PR agencies do operate in that way, but the reason why I was at One Green Bean for so long was because both were valued, and you know, we had a full creative department and strategy department and content, and you know, it was internally it kind of looked like a normal agency. I definitely agree that concepting in PR agencies is really shorter than it should be, and craft is not as important, because often you don't need the craft. But this is where OGB was different, because we would come back with ideas that were, you know, an instrument or a documentary or, you know, a film of some description. And so we would go through that crafting process. But yeah, PR agencies have a lot to learn from creative agencies and vice versa. Mm.
We touched on before the idea of sort of new generations of people coming into the creative industries, and I've talked on this podcast a bit about my passion for finding pathways into the industry for that new generation and different kinds of people, like you sort of said about when you started at Dad, one kind of person, whether, you know, whether we're talking about cultural background or whatever it might be. I feel as though there's a whole load of people that could be great at this but just never even know that it's a thing that exists, and we're fishing in a really, really narrow pool for people from a certain background or certain socioeconomic group. I think about Lebanese kids out west who could be amazing, but their dad just kind of says, well, I've got this mechanic business and you'll do that. Or Indian kids who could be great, but their parents say they could become doctors. I'm mega passionate about somehow reaching out to those people and bringing them in. Is that something that resonates with you?
Definitely. I actually think that by the time kids are sort of finishing high school, it's too late to reach them. I think if we really want to change the face of this industry, we have to start with kids when they're much younger, because by that point, their path has already been set by their parents or by the courses they've chosen or the classes. So I reckon it's really a case of getting in early and, you know, having really little kids engaging in what we do in advertising and opening their eyes to this whole other world, which is what happened to me, to be honest.
I do agree. It's just I think that, like, all is not lost if they get a bit older, because I think, like, you go into colleges or wherever, you go into any environment that's kind of not the usual environment, and you show them an instrument that's played by the wind, or you show them a really cool spoof trailer for Crocodile Dundee that's got Kenny Powers in it, or whatever, some of the cool shit that we do in this industry. And I think, you know, the people that are sort of that way inclined are going to go, wow, I could go and become a lawyer, or I could do cool shit like that. The other thing on this sort of related topic that I wanted to ask you about was that in the creating of this podcast, in the conversations kind of I've been having around it, some people, not in a gnarly way, but some people have said to me, well, just even focusing on people, you know, people from a certain kind of background, brown people, you know, and the whole brown thing is really metaphorical, by the way, because not everyone that's going to come on is going to be brown. Some people have said that it's a bit like positive discrimination. How do you sort of feel about that? That really upsets me, by the way. But
I don't agree. I think that ultimately we're in a position now where we have to overcorrect. And in order to do that, we need to focus on brown people or, you know, women or whatever the conversation is about. You know, diversity is bigger than just brown people, like you say. And I think that, you know, until now, the dominant gender or race has dictated the culture and the industry that we work in. And until we give people who are different a voice and forcibly do it, it's not going to change.
Agreed. And I also think that you can give those people a voice in a spirit of celebration and fun, and like not in a spirit of exclusion, because you can kind of open up the walls and sort of invite everyone in for that conversation. But I do agree, and Ash said something similar the other day on the podcast, that was, you know, we need to sort of just level the playing field. Then once we've levelled it, we can kind of talk about other ways to do things. Before we sign off, is there a final thought you want to leave us with?
I think the most important skill for people in this industry to own is empathy. It's obviously not just helpful for the job that we do and understanding audiences and how to sell to them, but it's also about how open we are to the people around us then. And I think that the more that we are empathetic towards people from different backgrounds and cultures, the more we're likely to let them in and be more involved and even buy an idea off them. they don't look like you. So I think everyone just needs to be a bit more empathetic. Generally people are, but I think being more aware of it would be helpful.
Do you mean that the people that we've got in the industry should become more empathetic, or that we should have we should create more empathy by having a more diverse set of people? The reason I ask that is because we've got a thing at Host Have Asked where we say, unless we kind of got a really varied, diverse inputs, the output's going to be kind of quite one-dimensional.
Definitely. I think it's both. I think it's about working with the people that are already in the industry to change their outlook so that they then open the doors to different types of people a bit more.
Okay, thank you. Pia, that has been awesome. Thank you very much for coming on. Okay, thanks again to Pia. Thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts. They're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again. Until next time.